In 2013, Apple's Tim Cook made a decision that would have bewildered Steve Jobs. Despite having $145 billion in cash reserves, Cook borrowed $17 billion to fund stock buybacks and dividends. Why? Financial engineering. Rather than bringing overseas cash home and paying taxes, Apple borrowed to temporarily boost share prices and please investors like Carl Icahn. This wasn't just an Apple quirk. It exemplified how American business priorities have fundamentally inverted. Finance now dictates terms to business rather than serving it. Makers and Takers by Rana Forohar has been hailed by economists like Joseph Stiglitz as essential reading for understanding how Wall Street's growing dominance threatens economic growth. The book resonated deeply with business leaders like Howard Schultz and policymakers like Elizabeth Warren, who have cited it when discussing America's broken financial system. Its cultural impact extended beyond economics, sparking conversations about the very purpose of capitalism in modern society. Our economic illness has a name: financialization, the trend by which Wall Street thinking has come to dominate America. It encompasses everything from finance's growing share of the economy to debt-fueled speculation replacing productive lending, the rise of shareholder value governance, and the increasing political power of financial institutions. We've even altered our language, speaking of human capital and securitizing everything from education to prison terms. The traditional role of finance, turning household savings into business investment, has been lost. Today's financial system mostly engages in alchemy, issuing massive debt and circulating money within itself rather than investing in Main Street. Former UK Financial Services Authority Chairman Adair Turner estimates a mere 15% of financial flows now go into real economy projects. The rest enriches financiers, corporate titans, and the wealthy who hold most financial assets. This shift toward a system where finance serves itself has been facilitated by decreased lending and increased trading, particularly computerized trading that now comprises about half of all U.S. stock market activity. The entire NYSE turns over every 19 months, triple the rate of the 1970s. With securities trading came a rise in debt of all kinds. Debt fuels finance's profits, even as research shows rising debt levels create financial instability. As finance has tripled its share of the U.S. economy in the post-war era, it has made debt indispensable for maintaining growth in an economy where stagnant wages can't support consumer spending. Former IMF chief economist Raghuram Rajan argued that credit became a palliative addressing deeper anxieties of middle-class downward mobility. Let them eat credit was the pre-crisis mantra. Meanwhile, lending to business, especially small business, has declined precipitously. In the early 1980s, commercial banks provided almost as much in loans to industrial and commercial enterprises as they did in real estate and consumer loans, 80% ratio. By 2005, that ratio had plummeted to just 28%. The wane in entrepreneurship means less economic vibrancy, since new businesses are the nation's foremost source of job creation and GDP growth. As Warren Buffett colorfully explained it, you've now got a body of people who've decided they'd rather go to the casino than the restaurant of capitalism. Finance has driven the drastic cutback in research and development spending in corporate America. If you chart the rise in money spent on share buybacks and the fall in corporate R&D spending, the two lines make a perfect X. S&P 500 firms now spend $1 trillion annually on buybacks and dividends, 95% of their net earnings, rather than investing in long-term growth. While other countries have larger banking sectors as a percentage of their economies, no country matches the United States in total financial assets, $81.7 trillion in early 2015, exceeding the combined total of the next three largest countries, China, Japan, and Germany. This massive scale represents a fundamental transformation of the American economy, where financial services now account for roughly 20% of corporate profits, up from just 10% in the 1970s. But contrary to conventional wisdom, this financial dominance hasn't made America more prosperous. Instead, it has deepened inequality and triggered destructive financial crises, including the devastating 2008 collapse. Multiple studies show countries with large, rapidly growing financial systems exhibit weaker productivity growth. According to the Bank for International Settlements, finance starts having adverse economic effects when it's only half its current size in the United States. The OECD and IMF have reached similar conclusions. The industry meant to facilitate growth has become a headwind against it. Research indicates that when financial sector growth exceeds GDP growth by 3-4%, it begins to crowd out real economic activity and talent from other sectors. This stems partly from decreased entrepreneurship and economic dynamism accompanying financial growth, as bright graduates increasingly choose Wall Street over Main Street ventures. The mounting monopoly power of large banks has become particularly concerning, with their share of banking assets tripling since the early 1970s. America's five largest banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs, now constitute half its commercial banking industry. Finance regularly outspends every other industry on lobbying, investing over $2.5 billion in the last decade alone, enabling it to shape regulation and tax codes, creating a system of crony capitalism that benefits insiders at the expense of the broader economy. One of the most pernicious effects has been massive inequality. Financial sector wages were high before the 1929 crash, fell after 1930s regulation, then grew wildly from the 1980s as finance was unleashed again through deregulation. The share of financiers within the top 1% nearly doubled between 1979 and 2005, reaching 14% of this elite group. The top 25 hedge fund managers earn more than all kindergarten teachers combined, over 180,000 of them, reflecting the skewed resource allocation of financialization. In 2020, the average Wall Street bonus was $184,000, while median household income remained around $67,000. Research proves that more inequality leads to poorer health outcomes, lower levels of trust, more violent crime, and less social mobility, all factors that destabilize society. Studies show that countries with high inequality have life expectancy gaps of up to 15 years between rich and poor neighborhoods, and children born into poverty have significantly reduced chances of climbing the economic ladder. As Thomas Piketty warned in his landmark work, Capital in the 21st Century, if current trends continue, the social unrest and economic upheaval could be terrifying, potentially threatening the very foundations of democratic capitalism. General Motors' 2014 ignition switch crisis, which resulted in at least 124 deaths and nearly $1.5 billion in penalties, stands as a stark example of how financialization corrupts corporate culture. The comprehensive Veloukis report investigating the crisis exposed a deeply dysfunctional culture dominated by bean counters rather than car guys. As former GM Vice Chairman Bob Lutz explained in his book, Car Guys vs. Bean Counters, financially oriented MBA managers consistently overruled experienced engineers, creating a culture where quarterly financial metrics and cost-cutting initiatives mattered more than product quality and safety. This misalignment of priorities led to absurd situations throughout the automotive industry. At Cadillac, engineers designed ashtrays to function at minus 40 degrees to meet arbitrary specifications, yet these same ashtrays wouldn't open at normal operating temperatures. At GM, the rigidly siloed corporate structure prevented vital communication between departments. People making airbags focused solely on airbags, while those designing switches only concentrated on switches, with no one responsible for how these components interacted. This transactional thinking encouraged employees to stay within their narrow job descriptions rather than thinking holistically about vehicle safety and customer experience. The result was a fragmented approach to product development where no single person or department had a complete view of potential safety issues. The shift toward balance sheet-driven management traces its roots to the early 20th century, emerging from the philosophy that if you could measure it, you could manage it. This approach fundamentally transformed American business culture, prioritizing markets over business operations, capital over labor, and short-term profits above long-term sustainability. GM CEO Alfred P. Sloan Jr. became the poster child for this new management philosophy, with his famous declaration that his goal was to make money, not just to make motor cars, a stark contrast to earlier industrialists who took pride in their products. This shareholder-first mentality received legal validation in the landmark 1919 Michigan Supreme Court case, Dodge versus Ford Motor Co., which established the precedent that a business corporation is organized and carried on primarily for the profit of the stockholders. The case arose when Henry Ford planned to reinvest $52 million in profits into building more factories and lowering car prices, rather than paying dividends to shareholders like the Dodge brothers. The court's ruling against Ford established the legal foundation for shareholder primacy, fundamentally altering corporate America's priorities for decades to come. Frederick Winslow Taylor's scientific management theory further transformed American business culture by placing workers in increasingly specialized and rigidly defined roles. His revolutionary time and motion studies meticulously timed workers with stopwatches, determining the most efficient methods down to the hundredth of a minute. This extreme specialization created new layers of bureaucracy. Shovel wielders needed shovel measurers, who needed supervisors, who required managers, leading to an exponential growth in middle management. As organizations grew more complex, top management became increasingly removed from the shop floor, focusing instead on processing data, operating statistics, distribution information, and financial metrics. The role of corporate leadership evolved into primarily a numbers job, with the controller, now known as the CFO, becoming the board's indispensable figure through whom all corporate information flowed. This transformation marked the beginning of an era where financial expertise trumped operational experience in corporate leadership. MIT professor Andrew Low discovered the devastating impact of financialization on pharmaceutical innovation when his mother was diagnosed with lung cancer. Researching her treatment options, he was shocked to learn from a biotech executive that finance drives our research agenda. Despite the decoding of the human genome creating unprecedented opportunities for breakthrough treatments, investment in early-stage biotech R&D was actually decreasing. Major pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer, with over $30 billion in cash reserves, focused on acquisitions and financial engineering rather than developing new drugs, following Wall Street's advice to exit research and create value through shareholder returns. Despite predictions that the 2008 financial crisis would trigger a crisis of capitalism and drive talent away from finance careers, MBA programs have never been more popular. The number of MBA graduates has skyrocketed since the 1980s. Yet during this same period, American business health has deteriorated by multiple metrics: declining corporate R&D spending, reduced new business creation, stagnating productivity, and plummeting public trust in business. Business education wasn't always finance-focused. In the early days, only one-fifth of corporate leaders had college degrees at the turn of the century. The first business schools, like Wharton, offered vocational training dedicated to growing local business ecosystems. These schools emphasized industry-specific expertise, labor relations, government relations, and engineering, with substantial focus on ethics. Joseph Wharton, a devout Quaker, believed commerce should solve social problems like inequality and job disruption. The Great Depression changed everything. The 1929 market crash made capitalism appear to have failed, pushing business leaders to defend themselves against rising Soviet influence. By the 1950s, business schools shifted to data-driven operations research, popularized by Rand, facilitated by new computers that could process massive amounts of data. This mathematical approach was partly funded by Rand fellowships at elite universities, serving the conservative elite's need to prove American-style business was superior to communism. The Chicago School's fundamental assumption, championed by Milton Friedman, was that a corporation's sole purpose is to maximize financial value. This paired with Eugene Fama's efficient market hypothesis, the idea that share prices perfectly reflect all known information and are thus the best measure of corporate value. Today's Finance 101 classes still teach that shareholder value trumps everything else, that people make rational economic decisions, and that a firm's share price is the ultimate measure of success. This mindset has shortened CEO tenures to less than 10 years and disconnected business leaders from any larger commitment to society. An Aspen Institute survey found that MBA students' values actually deteriorate during their education, shifting from stakeholder-focused to shareholder-focused by their second semester. Carl Icahn, Wall Street's richest man and feared corporate raider, spent years aggressively pressuring Apple to return its $200 billion cash reserves to investors through share buybacks rather than investing in R&D. His campaign included open letters to CEO Tim Cook, media appearances, and shareholder proposals. In April 2015, Icahn's efforts succeeded spectacularly when Apple announced the largest corporate payout in history, over $200 billion in dividends and buybacks between 2015-2017. Icahn, Apple's seventh largest shareholder, made $112 million in a single evening of after-hours trading following the announcement, on top of $125 million during regular trading hours, exemplifying how activist investors can generate massive personal wealth through financial engineering rather than value creation. Icahn represents a powerful wave of shareholder activists, a strategic rebranding of what were once called corporate raiders in the 1980s. Today's prominent activists include Bill Ackman, who waged a bitter battle against Herbalife, Daniel Loeb, known for his aggressive letters to Yahoo's board, David Einhorn, who sued Apple over its cash holdings, and Nelson Peltz, who targeted PepsiCo and DuPont. These activists have targeted major companies like Dell, Yahoo, Dow, JCPenney, GM, DuPont, Sears, and Hewlett-Packard, often demanding seat board seats, management changes, and increased payouts. Their growing influence correlates directly with record levels of buybacks and dividend payments, fundamentally reshaping corporate priorities. The pivotal year was 1982, when several regulatory changes transformed American business. The Supreme Court struck down a key anti-takeover law in Edgar v. Mite Corp. The Justice Department under William Baxter relaxed industry concentration limits, and most crucially, the SEC dramatically loosened Rule 10b-18 regulations that had previously prevented companies from buying back their own shares. SEC Chairman John Shadd, a former Wall Street executive and Reagan fundraiser, championed this change despite warnings from economists and regulators that it essentially legalized market manipulation and would lead to decreased corporate investment. The corporate shift from retain and reinvest to downsize and distribute has severely damaged American competitiveness. S&P 500 companies spent $4 trillion on buybacks between 2005 and 2015, 52.5% of net earnings, and another $2.5 trillion on dividends, 37.7%. By 2014, buybacks and dividends represented 105% of public companies' net earnings, rising above 115% in 2015. Companies like IBM, McDonald's, and Pfizer have spent more on buybacks than R&D and capital expenditures combined. While Warren Buffett has suggested buybacks can be appropriate when companies have ample cash and their stock is undervalued, academic research shows these conditions are rarely met. Most buybacks occur during market peaks rather than troughs, suggesting they're used to artificially extend bull markets rather than invest in genuine growth. Executives, who received 66 to 82% of their compensation in stock between 2006-2012, personally benefit from this practice through increased stock prices and earnings per share metrics that trigger bonuses. Public markets have become increasingly hostile to innovation as activist investors push for short-term gains over long-term objectives. Private and family-owned businesses offer a striking contrast in their approach to capital allocation. These firms invest more than twice as much in the real economy as similar-sized public companies in the same sectors, focusing on R&D, employee training, and capital equipment. They've weathered economic crises better and are achieving stronger growth. A 2015 survey by PwC found 31% of major private companies increased profit margins, while most public firms saw flattening or contracting margins. Companies like Mars, Bechtel, and Cargill demonstrate how private ownership enables longer-term strategic thinking and sustained investment. In April 2015, GE CEO Jeffrey Immelt announced a landmark shift. The company would divest its massive financial arm, GE Capital, and return to its industrial manufacturing roots. This marked a dramatic reversal for a company that had transformed from America's original innovator into one of the world's largest financial services firms, a too-big-to-fail entity that required $139 billion in government-guaranteed loans during the 2008 crisis. The transformation of GE from an industrial powerhouse to a quasi-bank symbolized a broader shift in American capitalism. Since the 1970s, companies across sectors have increasingly derived revenues from financial activities rather than production, a phenomenon economists term financialization. By the late 1980s, financial revenue ratios reached 5 times their post-war levels and continued rising through the 1990s and 2000s. Today's corporations exemplify this trend with record-high borrowing, share buybacks, dividend payments, outsourcing, and tax optimization, all while investment in jobs, factories, and innovation remains near record lows. The S&P 500 companies spent over $7 trillion on buybacks and dividends between 2004 and 2014 alone. The shift to financial activities has transformed traditional industrial sectors. Automakers like GM and Ford generate up to 30% of their profits from car loans and leasing rather than vehicle sales. Their financing arms have essentially become banks, often making more money from interest payments than from the cars themselves. Energy companies actively speculate in oil futures and derivatives, undermining their core business by creating market volatility that makes long-term planning difficult. Airlines have become sophisticated financial players, with companies like Southwest often making more money hedging oil prices than selling airfare, though this strategy backfired dramatically when oil prices plunged 50% in 2014-2015, costing the industry over $1 billion in bad bets. American corporations embraced finance because it promised higher profits with less investment than traditional manufacturing. As the U.S. economy shifted from manufacturing to services, financial activities became particularly attractive, requiring only a few very clever people and super-fast computers rather than factories and equipment. This shift accelerated as Wall Street began rewarding companies for financial engineering over operational excellence. Jack Welch epitomized this approach during his tenure at GE, slashing R&D spending from 2% to 1% of revenue, cutting over 100,000 jobs, and selling core industrial divisions while promising shareholders 15% annual earnings growth, all based on the belief that finance was an easy way to make money compared to building factories and bending metal day after day. Under his leadership, GE Capital grew to account for nearly half of the company's profits. However, financial engineering introduces hidden risks into businesses despite rising share prices. The obsession with accounting tricks, spreadsheets, and shareholder primacy plants what one critic called dynamite in secret places throughout corporations. GE exemplified this danger. Unregulated by the Federal Reserve until after the 2008 crisis, its creative accounting and AAA rating allowed it to borrow more cheaply than competitors, becoming so leveraged it couldn't operate without selling billions in commercial paper daily. When credit markets froze in 2008, this dependency nearly destroyed the company, requiring massive government intervention to prevent collapse. Our system of market capitalism isn't divinely ordained, but rather a set of rules we've crafted that can be remade to better serve shared prosperity and economic growth. 5 fundamental ideas could reintegrate finance into the real economy, transforming our current dysfunctional system into one that works for everyone. First, our financial system must become simpler and more transparent. Financial institutions have become too complex to manage. Even the most sophisticated risk managers struggle to track millions of daily transactions in an $81.7 trillion system. The contrast between Dodd-Frank's sprawling 2,319 pages and Glass-Steagall's concise 37 pages illustrates how lobbying has complicated regulation and created new loopholes. essential reforms include mandatory trading of all derivatives on regulated exchanges, comprehensive regulation of shadow banking activities like money market funds and repo markets, elimination of offshore banking havens, closure of mark-to-market accounting loopholes, and implementation of a financial transaction tax to discourage excessive speculation. Second, we must reduce our dangerous dependence on debt financing. Extensive research demonstrates that excessive credit actively harms economic growth beyond certain thresholds. When private sector credit expansion exceeds GDP growth by more than 3 to 5% annually, financial crises and slower growth inevitably follow. Countries with oversized financial sectors consistently show greater economic instability, yet our tax system continues to subsidize debt creation through interest deductibility while penalizing equity financing. Governments often encourage credit issuance as an easy alternative to addressing fundamental economic challenges like aging populations, technological disruption, and inequality. Third, the shareholder primacy model requires serious reexamination. Short-term focused activist investors prioritize quick stock price appreciation over long-term company viability, creating a vicious cycle where businesses avoid productive investment, economic growth stagnates, and financial institutions push increasingly risky consumer debt products to maintain profits. Practical solutions include strict limits on share buybacks, graduated capital gains taxes that reward longer holding periods, prohibitions on quarterly earnings guidance, and restrictions on stock option executive compensation that encourages short-term thinking. Fourth, we urgently need a new growth model. Financialization both causes and results from slower real economic growth, as policymakers increasingly turn to financial engineering for quick fixes to deep structural problems. The 2008 global financial crisis and China's recent economic troubles clearly demonstrate how countries use debt and financial market manipulation to artificially boost growth instead of developing genuine economic strength through innovation and productivity gains. America needs an ambitious moonshot growth goal, like clean energy independence or breakthrough medical technologies, that could unite the country and drive sustainable innovation. Finally, we must fundamentally change the narrative and empower the makers over the takers. Despite its problems, America remains the world's strongest economy, and reforming our financial system could put the entire global economy on a better path. We need markets structured with the genuine equal access that Adam Smith envisioned, a political economy not captured by moneyed interests, and a financial sector that serves business and society rather than just itself. The financial industry needs its own version of medicine's Hippocratic Oath, first, do no harm, along with a renewed focus on how finance can serve the real economy and society. By putting finance back in service to all stakeholders, we can create a more prosperous future where makers, not takers, drive economic progress through genuine value creation rather than financial engineering.